Right, welcome back everybody. We are talking with Ola Damegård about the murder of Olof Palme. A very interesting story, of course, very, very suspicious murder case, and so many things is just gone awry with this case, with as with so many others as well. And we're trying to, of course, make some of the comparisons and a broad overview here, detailed to you what actually has happened, how many things have when it comes to the investigation, have basically just been thrown off, and people have been thrown red herrings, and we're going to, you know, detail more of this stuff. But basically, one thing we want to make sure we mention again here is that the patsy, Christer Pettersson, that we were offered, he comes along, as you detailed before, so much later in the process that it's not even worth your time at this stage to look at him. He's thrown in front of us as being the patsy. And it's really obvious at that point. What you've detailed to me, though, in the break is that you told me one of the most important aspects in this is how everything was delayed as it was happening. You mentioned about 5 hours before actually any police officers are basically sent out and something begins to happen. Tell us about this delay again. It's really, really important.
What happened was that at that evening, there was a lot of key people that was exchanged with people from a little group of right extremist policemen from central Stockholm. They went under the name of the Baseball Gang. They were a very violent gang that was actually created by Hans Holmér, who was the chief investigator of the Palme assassination. He created this group a few years before that. And their task was to clean the streets and whatever, you know, clean, take away trash, as they call it, like drug addicts or whatever. And what they did was they were called a baseball gang because they came in civilian clothes with baseball caps and sometimes baseball bats, and they were just beating the shit out of anyone that came in their way. And they were, like I say, a very, very violent right extremist gang from Norrmalms police station. Then the Norrmalms police station is one of the most central police areas in Stockholm, and it involves all the central, like the castle, the government buildings, and all of these involved there. This police station had a very the years coming up to the assassination, there was a very big concentration of right-wing policemen. They were sort of attracted to this station. And this little group, there were only like 8 or 10 people, are extremely central in this assassination. Because what happened was that exact night, they jumped into key positions. Like one of them were driving one of the ambulances that was supposed to pick up the prime minister after he was shot. One of the people was put in just that evening at the communication central where the telephone calls came in from the site, where witnesses called in and said, somebody has been shot, somebody like that. They put one guy there. The first police cars, not the really the first one, but the police vans that came and then started the hunt for the assassin, all of them were from the same little group. And key people that keeps popping up around the investigation in very, very strange areas are from this small group. They were later the chief investigator, Hans Holmér's bodyguards. They were involved in weapon smuggling. They were involved in, like I say, many, many very strange areas. And at this very night, they were in all the key positions. And what happened was that when the shots were fired, everything was delayed. Nothing happened. When people called in, make an alarm about what happened, they didn't pick up the phone. So people were standing waiting. Then when they got through, it was delayed for several minutes again. And then there was no alarm going out, no alert going out to all police cars in central Stockholm, which would be natural, even though they didn't know it was the
Prime Minister.
The Prime Minister. Mm. But if there was a shooting normally there's an alarm going out that alerts everyone in central cities so that you can sort of stop the roads, block the roads, and get hold of the guys.
Yeah.
The whole night, no one in central Stockholm, in the police stations around in Stockholm, had no idea what happened. People abroad in the States and other states, they found out about the assassin long before the Swedish people were told.
Such a classic. The lid is on right away. And it's very centralized as well in Sweden. And everybody is waiting for authority to give the instructions about what's going on, pretty much. There's no individual initiative or incentive in that way, and it's very centralized, basically. And this is one prime example when that's a really bad idea. It's in these kinds of situations.
But in this point, it was even worse than that, because the only alarm that was sent out went to these specific police cars where these members of the baseball gang were.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't go out to any other police cars.
Now, have you theorized about how that would be possible? Is it just the right person in the right place taking the call, for instance, that would be able to handle this, or how would this be?
You have to be very good to be able to do that. You know, you can't do it. Things like this cannot happen just by coincidence.
Sure. Yeah.
And then once again, if one thing happened, okay, fine. It could be a coincidence. It could be a mistake. If two things happened, fine, mistake. Three, okay. But like thousands, we're talking thousands over the years of really, really strange things that adds up to a very different picture than the official version. Anyway, then finally it came out that they went out with alarm saying that the wife of the prime minister had seen two people, probably from the Croatian resistance movement called Ustasha. So the first alarm that went out was that there was two people from Ustasha, yeah? And that went out like 2:05. The assassination was about 20 minutes past 11 in the evening. So we're talking almost 2.5 hours later. It's the first alarm going out that, well, the prime minister has been shot, burr, 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 like this. We're looking for two people. Then overnight, it changes. So 5:00 in the morning, suddenly it's one person, different look, and no mention of Ustasha. But at 5:06 in the morning, that's when the actual alarm went out. We're talking like 6-hour delay.
Yeah.
And it's the prime minister that has been shot. It's not just anyone. You know, Stockholm by then, it was totally dead. Nobody reacted. All the witnesses that had seen something that came up to the police saying, I saw him run that way. They said, okay, fine, I'll take your number. Never called them back.
Mm.
Okay, another one came. I saw him run this way. What did he look like? Well, he was blonde. Oh, sorry, we're not interested in blonde people like that. Another woman who saw the guy run away, so she came up to the police and said, I saw the shooter. They said, thank you very much, but we already got a witness. So they didn't hear her either.
Mm.
There was a TV team that came from TV2 in Sweden that was driving around just making a program about something else. And they saw that something happened. So they stopped and asked one of the police. And the police said, oh, it's just there's been a knife fight between some immigrants here, you know. So they took off as well. They had no idea. And it just continues like that.
Very interesting. Now, what happened with Lisbeth Palme, the wife of Olof Palme? There have been some strange things here. She's refused to testify or reveal details about the witness. Tell us about this.
Everything around her is so, so strange. But let me go back to the shooting itself. Because, like I said, the killer came up behind, shot the prime minister with one shot, and then fired another shot after her. The official story is that the bullet just touched her without really making a wound on her back.
Just brushing her, basically, yeah.
It looked like she had been whipped or something like that. Okay, if you're standing at the site and you look at how the shooter was aiming, in what directions and so on, officially, he was shot by a .357 Magnum with a Smith & Wesson. I mean, we're talking about, at that point, one of the most powerful handguns in the world, not a toy gun, okay? Where did they find the bullet? They found it 37 hours after the assassination, 7 meters from where he was hit, on the back behind a concrete pillar. 7 meters, and that was after everything had been, you know, the technical investigation had been there. They had swept up everything. They checked everything, you know, blah, 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 blah. And then, boom, the bullet is found. 7 meters from where he was shot, behind a concrete. You tell me how that is possible. Okay, that was one bullet. That was the Olof bullet, the one that supposedly killed Olof Palme. The one that was fired at Lisbeth Palme, it was fired direction Sergels Torg, and it's got the normal range of a bullet like that is about 2 kilometers for the bullet to come down if it doesn't hit anything. Where was it found? It was found 40 meters in a totally different direction on the other side of the road, very nicely put on top of a little snow pile like that, where they had already made it a technical investigation, not finding anything.
Well, see, that's bad planting of evidence there, right? It's not a well done kind of...
It's super bad.
Yeah.
It's super bad.
So why is that? If they're so well thought out in some circumstances, when it comes to this, they're all of a sudden just, they falter and just can't do it right. Why is that, do you think?
We need to get back to this later on, because this is, something happens during the night that totally messes everything up.
Okay.
That has, so they have to rethink everything. That is why it's delayed. That is what is causing this massive delay. But it's a lot, I think it's a lot better if we get to that later on, because...
Sure, I'll make a note about that, keep it in mind, and we'll keep going.
Okay, so these two bullets are found in a very strange place. None of them are damaged in any way, which would be normal. I mean, the bullet could have ended up there if it had hit like a house or you know, anything hard, but it would almost have disintegrated or been damaged somehow. But it was the Lisbeth bullet was pristine, you know, beautiful, absolutely beautiful, put on top of a little pile of snow. And who found it? I mean, we're getting into strange land here now. It was a Indian freelance journalist who sat at home and heard about the assassination. This is what he says himself. He went down to the assassination site and then he put himself in trance to find the bullet. So he was walking around in trance and then he felt, here it is, and he pointed in front of himself and he was pointing right at this bullet. Right. And then he picked it up and gave it to a policeman. Okay, fine. fine. The other one was found by a woman that worked at Sveriges Radio, the radio, national radio station. It was found out. Both of them, these people, worked for Sveriges Radio. I'm not trying to make anything suspicious about these people, but if you look at around 9/11, for instance, like all the eyewitnesses that was interviewed while it was happening were somehow connected to the different TV stations.
That's right, yeah.
All of them. And here we are again with some people that apparently have no connection, but they do. Anyway,
yeah.
The reason my theory about why they were dropped or put where they were that something happened, like I said, and they had to plant evidence for plan B to get another plan going. But by then, the assassination site was so filled with people and roses, and also the stripes, you know, these plastic stripes that the police put out around the assassination site. And that went across this around this concrete pillar. So the only place that there were no people looking at the site was behind it.
I see.
And that is exactly where somebody dropped the bullet, because that was the only place where nobody would see him do it.
So they couldn't plant the evidence at the time because there were people there. It was closed off. They couldn't do it. But for some reason, they didn't do it right away. They had to. No. They were waiting for some reason.
Yeah, exactly. And if we can get back to that, maybe in chapter two or whatever,
sure,
because there's so much before that.
Okay. Okay.
But when it comes to Lisbeth Palme, it's said that the shot passed through. She had a coat on, and a t-shirt and a white shirt on, and it's said that the bullet went in through the fur, and passed along her back, inside her shirt, and then came out and left on the other side of the jacket of the coat. In the shoulder height, sort of. There's only a problem here because one thing is, if it's a 357 Magnum, even if the bullet doesn't touch you, it still makes a massive damage if it passes like a centimeter from your body because the pressure in the air is so heavy.
Mm.
So you would get a real wound by that. Here, no one has ever seen this wound. No doctor was allowed to see it. She didn't allow anyone. Nobody noticed that she was shot at all. That was first afterwards that they claimed at the hospital. It said that she said, I have some pain in my back. Could you please check? And the one who checked it was Olof Palme's brother-in-law, mm-hmm. his sister's husband. He was the one. He's the only one who's officially seen it. And a police officer as well, who's now dead. Anyway, but they described it very different. Like one said it was like 2-3 millimeters deep, which is quite a big wound, you know, on a shoulder blade.
Sure, yeah.
And like a stripe along the back, you know, like a whip mark. And the other one said it's just a light red line. But she never allowed anyone to examine it. She never, anyway. Okay, the official version said that she jumped into the ambulance together with her husband and took off for the hospital. But for some reason, the ambulance didn't go straight to the hospital. It was delayed somewhere, and when it arrived to the hospital, she was in a police car. There are some photos. There was a photographer from a newspaper who's taken photo of her when she jumps out the police car and starts running into the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
The only problem is that the coat she's got on there is not the same coat that has been presented as evidence with the bullet holes in.
Yeah.
Can you see? We got a bit of a problem here.
Sure, sure. Yeah.
Also, it's like when you see her shirt, the bullet goes in. And there's another out, and then there's an in hole, but there's no out.
It's like the magic bullet of JFK, almost a similar one.
Exactly, exactly. The whole thing with these assassinations is that it's very easy to keep track of truth. If everybody is truthful, what happened happened. Boom, no problem. But if you start lying or start covering up, the more people involved, the more lies, the more strange things, the more mess you get out of it. And this is a massive mess on all areas.
A lot of inconsistencies here, yeah.
Of extreme inconsistency, which is perfect for someone like me who are just like, it's being given gifts, you know, like, look at this one. Oh my God. Because I always look at it as like Farmer Brown logic, you know, 1 + 1 = 2. Even if you got a white coat and you're called something fancy, if you say 1 + 1 = 37, it is not true.
Yep.
You know?
Yep.
So back to basic, make it simple. And the truth is very simple. And lies are complicated. It gets very complicated. I feel sorry for these people who are involved to have to cover up all the time because it cannot be easy.
And it's been going for quite a few years now. Some investigators have looked into it, and there's also, well, there's two aspects I want to talk about. One is media complicity in this as well, because the big problem in Sweden is we have a subsidized press corps. They're basically on the payroll of the government or whoever is giving the orders at the time, And yeah. There's very few private investigators, individual journalists who look into things. And even if they are, like yourselves, their story is never heard. So again, it's more centralization, and it's very difficult to break through. Anything you want to comment on about that?
I can just totally agree with what you just said. In my opinion, there's only been like a handful of real journalists who have been looking into them. One of them, which I'm full of admiration for, is his name is Lars Borgnäs. And he is one of the truth seekers. He's done an amazing job over the years trying to find out what happened, you know, doing what a journalist is supposed to do. Then you got another one, Sven Anér, who was, he used to work for Dagens Nyheter. And then after he retired, he got totally obsessed with trying to find out what happened here, you know. And and he's had his whole life more or less demolished, you know, being, now he's seen upon as a crazy guy, an extremist, you know, nobody's taking him serious. But he is very, very good as well. He never gives up. And then you have a few authors like Gunnar Wall. You got, there's two brothers that they wrote a book that's really good. It's called Inside the Labyrinth. It's about the what happened. There's 6 minutes around the assassination where everything is a mess because the people behind the conspiracy had a massive problem because there were police cars coming to the assassination site before the alarm went out. Can you see? Here's another problem.
Sure.
Officially, nobody has made the alarm yet, and they're already there. Problem.
And these people are basically never heard. They're discredited, as you said.
Yeah. It's like Sven Anér has written, I don't know, 8-10 books or something like that.
Wow.
He's published them himself. And there are just no reviews. There's no nothing. That's why I could have published my own book years ago, but I just know it would just be meant. It would be met with total silence, no reaction, and I would be ridiculed or whatever. You know, on a very early stage, I found out that if you really want to make a difference, if you really want to dig into this, either you have to get in the spotlight. So you have some kind of safety from having the spotlight on you, or keep a very, very low profile.
That's right. Now there are. Sorry. Go ahead.
No, because I've seen quite a few people get their lives totally smashed, crashed. I've seen very strange suicides. I've seen close friend dies. You know, it's like it's not a nice thing.
No, it's absolutely not.
It's a scary area to get into.
Now, there are different diversions. There are so-called whitewashes happening. There's a few movies and TV programs that have been released about it. One of the movie was called The Last Contract, Sista Kontraktet in Svenska, Swedish. And what do you think about some of these as you've been watching the story following so close yourself, and then these kinds of movies are released? What's your opinion about them?
I had very high expectations with The Last Contract, but when I saw it, it was like, what is this? You know, there was it had nothing to do, or very, very little to do with what actually happened, what people saw and so on. It was absolute disappointment. And then quite a few of the so-called documentaries that have been made afterwards, if you check out who is owning the production company who made them, you see once again part of the same cover-up as the rest. And more or less all of them are pointing at Christer Pettersson.
Oh, yeah.
Which is the official version.
Yeah.
I used to make music for TV4, and I went around with, there's a German documentary, it's called Murder in Stockholm. You can find it on YouTube now. It's a really, really good one. It's one of the best ever made, I think. And it won prizes as the best documentary of the year in Germany in 1996, I think, and it got prizes in Italy as well. It was never, ever aired in Sweden, as far as I know, officially.
Yeah.
No. And I went to TV4's, they had a special program called Kalla Fakta. And I went there and just said, please, can you have a look at this and you may see, and if you like it, move on, you know. And he said, what's this about? And I said, well, it's about the Palme assassination and so on, about the conspiracy. He said, is it about Christer Pettersson? I said, no. He said, then we're not interested. How can you, as a journalist on a national TV station, not be interested? Just have a look. If you think it's crap, throw it out. If you think it's good, air it. But have a look. Mm. No. A very strange again.
Yeah. Yeah, no surprise there. There's been some other journalists as well, well-known names, if you will, in Sweden, like Jan Gu, Robert Aschberg. They've also been very much like gatekeepers, if you will, in this situation. They made fun of people who actually have done real investigations, etc. Yeah. It just goes on and on, doesn't it?
I think it's very interesting that you mention these two people, because if you look at the people who have been driving this Christer Pettersson track or whatever you want, trail or whatever you want to call it, it's Robert Aschberg from TV3, and it's his brother Rickard Aschberg at Aftonbladet, which is one of the main newspapers in Sweden. And Rickard Aschberg had a colleague called what's his name, Lennart Hård. These three people are the ones that have been pushing this whole thing all the time, pointing at Christer Pettersson again and again and again and again. And at least with Rickard Aschberg and Lennart Hård, things taken right out of the blue, you know. One of the best one I thought was when they found a Smith & Wesson revolver in a lake.
Was it a lake or the river close by there?
No, in a lake.
In a lake, okay, yeah.
And I loved it. It was absolutely wonderful, hilarious. It was all rusty, and then on the handle of the gun, there were the initials carved CHR. CHP, like Christer Pettersson, almost.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And then there was a little piece of paper saying, "Forgive me, Lisbeth." Okay.
Oh, wow.
Oh my God, it gives you tears in your eyes. It's so sentimental. The only problem was that the gun was from 1987 and the assassination took place in 86.
That's right.
Come on, guys. Yeah. Make it a bit better.
Well, again, we're back to that. It's like, on one level, it's genuinely like brilliant pulled off, and then in another, it's really shoddy. You know, the rest of the cover up things are like embarrassing. Now, I'm still trying to figure that out. The discrepancy there.
No, but it's like, I tell you, at one point I almost wanted to go to the secret police in Sweden and saying, "Come on, hire me, guys. You know, I can do this a lot better than you, because I'm used to finding faults." But they're so not afraid of being caught. And some of these people are not very clever either, I tell you.
No. Aschberg, you know, Robert Aschberg, he's from a prominent family in Stockholm. Yeah. His grandfather was a big banker involved in some interesting things. And he has brought out a lot of things. And he was even, there's been a lot of scandal around him in different ways. And he seems to be on one level in charge of the, well, of kind of driving the cover up in the media and thwarting and steering the debate into a certain area in a way. He seems to have been very much involved in that, if you ask me.
Yeah, I totally agree. And then you have, you mentioned Jan Guillou, and you've got another guy called Leif G. Persson, who's a police professor.
Yeah.
These two guys, Jan Guillou is a guy that came, he was a journalist, a left-wing journalist, who officially discovered that there was a secret, how would you describe the IB there? There was a secret surveillance of the population,
right.
The left wing. And he and another journalist, Peter Bratt, and the whistleblower, these three were sentenced to one year in jail by Olof Palme indirectly. After that, he came out as a hero.
Jan Guillou did, Peter Bratt. Peter Bratt was really onto something. He was he was definitely more genuine, I think, than Jan Guillou. But the fact is that he was discredited afterwards. He hasn't worked in any major publications. But Jan Guillou was raised to, you know, incredible heights after he was spent a year of martyrdom in prison, for sure.
Yeah. But Jan Guillou is a very strange person, in my opinion.
I agree.
What very few people know is that according to some experts in the area, they claim that he was working for IB. He was an IB agent in Eastern Europe at the same time as he uncovered it. And for 5 years, he was a SÄPO informer as well, which is the secret police of Sweden, which when he was confronted with this fact, he admitted it in Expressen, I think it was 1995 or something like that. And also this guy, where did he get all the knowledge from regarding all the secret police, all of these undercover agent worlds? Because he's very, very, very sharp when it comes to details. Anyway, that guy, Jan Guillou, was sort of like the saint of journalists, the one you could trust, the one that stood up for the for what is right and so on. But when it came to Palmemordet, the assassination of Olof Palme, and other very controversial areas like the Styckmordet, I don't know what you call that, the decapitation
right,
case.
Yeah.
There was a prostitute that was found chopped to pieces. When you around the, I think the Estonia as well, he is the first one to go out and just totally trash anyone who's trying to find out what really happened.
Yeah.
And that does not make any sense in my world if he is who he thinks he is. And I used to be part of a little group called the Private Investigators, the Privatspanarna, which was a small group of mainly elder men who was very, very sad to see what had happened in Sweden and was so trying to find out what happened, you know, what happened in our beautiful country. These people were often, they were lawyers, they were on a high level, very well-educated people, and a few nutcases as well. Some of them, I think, they were planted there to give us a bad rap.
Right. You know?
And any time that there were meetings or anything that this group brought forward, Jan Guillou was the first one to just trash it, you know, and Robert Aschberg as well,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And we were called crazy and, you know, just a laughing stock, whatever. Mm. And to this day, it's like every time there's one of these, when you get close to something, Jan Guillou goes out, stops it.
That's
it's
right.
Like he's like a bloodhound for the establishment, I would say.
I agree. Very, very suspicious. And he, of course, gets more airtime than most other people as well. Whatever he says, you know, that goes. Now, The IB affair, people can read more about that. Again, it's one of these stories that have huge connections to so many different things around. But there was this case as well. And since we're on the topic of Olof Palme, I wanted to bring that in because I'm sure you're familiar about Doris Hopp's brothel that was in Stockholm. And the IB, you know, affair was actually, it was kind of unfolded because of this, because there was a lot of politicians at the time. They were accused of, you know, having sex with minors. They allegedly were visiting this brothel in Stockholm, and this was back in the 70s. And you had former Prime Minister Torbjörn Fälldin. He was accused of being one of them. The other former Center Party leader Olof Johansson as well, and also Olof Palme was accused of being involved in this. And I wanted to bring that up because it's so interesting to see that this pattern seems to be existent in so many other countries as well. That the major politicians are they attend brothels or they even have sex with minors. There seems to be something involved with blackmail, possibly, that you can't attain a certain level within politics unless you actually are willing to go into some of these situations so that you can blackmail people in case they start to go out of bounds, pretty much. But what's your take on the IB affair? This idea that, you know, many of these major Swedish politicians at the time might have been going to the brothels, you know, in Stockholm. Do you think the allegations are true?
I think it's absolutely true. Absolutely. And like you say, if you look on a broader scale, on an international scale, it's the same again and again and again. And one of the reasons they're doing, I think you were spot on there when you said it, that these parties are arranged, you know, Temptation, come to me, come to me, parties are made. And especially people, when they're new in the power corridors, and so they're flattered by being one of the gang and stuff like that. So they join and they go to places like this, not knowing this. I don't know for sure, but I feel deeply in my heart that what happened is that they got involved with minors or homosexual acts or whatever, and it was caught on films and tape recordings and all of that to be used if they started saying things against the establishment or whatever, just like J. Edgar Hoover did. And I think this is one of the tasks that Ebbe Carlsson was doing. He was arranging these parties to get people around the balls, you know.
Well, exactly. I wanted to bring up another case, rumors about the former Danish prime minister, and he's head of NATO now. What's his name again? I forget his name.
I don't know.
Anyway, he's also been caught, like, dressed up in women's clothing and kind of...
Yeah, but it's... If you look at the... It's the same that goes again and again. It's cross-dressing, homo sex, minor... Sex with minors.
Yeah.
It's just... There's a lot of sick things going on, if you think that is sick, but I don't think it's that normal.
Of course not, no.
And on these levels of power... I don't know what it is, but also around the Kennedy assassination and also I think around the Olof Palme assassination, with these right-wing, very militant people, there's a lot of homosexual activity going on there as well. I'm not saying anything against homosexual, not at all. I'm just saying that there's a lot of these things going on. It seems like I don't know if it's the male energy, you know, weapons, violence, and that females don't really fit in there.
Well, it's true.
I don't know what it is.
It's an interesting discrepancy. There seems to be a hate almost of women in these all-men organizations, actually, at times. Yeah. It's very strange. The one I was thinking about, by the way, the head of NATO currently, the Secretary General, is Anders Fogh Rasmussen. He was the one I was thinking about, by the way. And same thing there. He's been allegedly, you know, seen walking home from parties and stuff like that in women's clothing. Some kind of weird thing that they're using them for blackmail purposes and they bring them to these kind of orgy parties or whatever it is that they have. You know, it's eyes wide shut, pretty much.
Exactly. It's hard to believe to start with, but then you come across it again and again and again.
Let's talk a little bit here, Ulla, about the Freemasonic connections. I do want to get into P. Due, Propaganda Due, Licio Gelli, and I was really it was well received from me that you brought this up in the book as well. It's a trail I've been watching myself and following up on. What is the column again? They call him the Swedish tree, Palme, right? The tree must fall. Tell us about this a little bit.
This was, it's like when you start digging into these things, you start seeing that the connection gets higher and higher and higher and higher. I thought it was a Swedish assassination to start with, but then over the years, it's just grown bigger and bigger. And this, what you're talking about is, it's called the Telegram Trail, is what it's been named. It was like 3 days before the assassination, there was a telegram sent from the P2 Lodge in Italy, which is a Freemasonic lodge under Licio Gelli. The telegram was sent from the P2 Lodge to one of George Bush Sr.'s advisors or secretaries called, what's his name, Guarino, something like that, mm-hmm. Paul Guarino, I think. Mm-hmm. And the telegram said, please tell our good friend Bush that the Swedish tree will be fallen. And there's been a lot of speculations about the Swedish tree since Palme's name was Palm. That was what was talked about, that they were predicting the assassination of Olof Palme.
The palm tree, yeah.
The palm tree will be fallen. And 3 days later, he was actually killed.
Yeah.
And when you look into it, George Bush Sr. is very, very central in, if not all than many, many of the major terror acts or assassinations. He's a central figure in all of them.
Let's talk about incentive a little bit while we're on that subject. We have interesting telegrams being flown, you know, across the world basically here, detailing that something might be up. Why do you think they wanted to take him out? Some of the reasons, and again, before we get into that, I just want to preface again. Think back again to the double standard, the weird two-facedness that you mentioned before of Olof Palme. The fact that he seems to be almost like a double agent, triple agent. He's in working for the, well, I guess so-called left side at the time, but he comes from a, you know, right-wing background, and it seems like he's a cog, a wheel in a bigger machine, basically. And I think that many people are used for different purposes that might be ideologically and well-meaning in the beginning when they're driven and get into politics, but then after a while, they might even realize that they're being used, or they're you know, content even with the idea that they are being used for something bigger. But it seems to me that they were using Olof Palme for a while for a specific purpose to direct the country into a certain direction. But then after a while, they didn't want him anymore. He served the purpose. It was time for the country maybe to go into another direction. And they decided to basically take him out. What do you think?
I think that he was very aware of this double play from day one, from very young age. Olof Palme came from, like we said, a very bourgeois, upper class family, with very, very strange connections, family connections. He had an uncle that was later convicted in Nuremberg at the trials after the Second World War. He was convicted for crimes against humanity. He had been part of creating Auschwitz and the mustard gas. No, not the other gas they were using there. He had family members that was connected to the spy cell where Kim Philby and Guy Burgess and these people came from. He had a connection with Alan Dulles and John Foster Dulles, you know, the people that were later, Alan Dulles was later the chief of CIA who was kicked out by JFK and was later very much involved in the assassination of JFK, and also a member of the Warren Commission who was covering the whole thing up. He was actually, as far as I've been able to find out, he came as a guest in Olof Palme's house when he was younger. Very strange. Anyway, but Olof Palme started his military education within the Forsvars, the secret. I'm sorry, I do not know the English word from it, but by he was on a very early stage, he was part of building up the Stay Behind movement.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And then later he was recommended by Erdmann, a former Nazi who turned into a social democrat. He was the one who recommended him as like a secretary type to Torge Lande, who was also deeply, he was the former prime minister and deeply involved in Stay Behind and the whole build-up of the ghost army, of the NATO ghost army in Sweden. It's said that he came from a very right-wing way of looking upon things, and then he went to the States and hitchhiked around, and when he saw the poverty in the South, he suddenly turned around and became very social democrat, left-wing, which is, it's possible, but when you look at his actions afterwards, I think that what he did there was that he took on a role as being left, a liberal social democrat. Yeah.
We see this, by the way, all the time as well, this kind of flip-flopping back and forth. And also, I mean, from my point of view politically, it's these sides are used against each other, and people are swayed to go along with one side or the other to basically end up in an internal struggle and a strife to be fooled and duped basically by this dialectic system. And while society is slowly going down the drain, people are going nowhere. And it's so obvious to me, but still many people are drawn into the left-right kind of battle and paradigm, if you will.
We're talking about theater, you know, a theater for the masses.
Yep.
You play right, I play left. let's have an argument and then one of us will win. But the machine behind us is the one and the same.
That's
just
right.
Pushing forward.
Yeah.
And anyway, so at the same time, when after Olof Palme became prime minister and went up in the ranks within politics, he became a very powerful politician. He was a very controversial, with very strong opinions, and he was loved by some, hated by many, really hated. He always created very strong feelings.
There have been a few other cases, consequently, in Sweden. We have the one of Anna Lindh, for example. And one of the central themes there seems to be that she was very, very outspoken against Israel. What's the connection there with Palme? Was he was, as you said before, very pro-PLO, right? The Palestinian the liberation organization, right?
He was very pro PLO. At the same time, he was working for big business. You know, so it's very double.
Yeah.
And I think once again we're talking about acting out a role. You know, I think that when he went into this demonstration with a Vietnamese ambassador in Stockholm, standing up against the states. You know, the USA, nobody dared to raise a critical finger at that point. He did, and that made him a symbol in the whole world for someone who dared to stand up for these things. By doing that, it opened all the doors to these smaller countries, the other side, you know, like Cuba, Palestine, all of these ones, the Sandinist government, they opened the doors for him because they saw him as a hero. I see it as he was playing
a Trojan horse, basically.
Yeah, exactly a Trojan horse. Yeah, and that at the same time as he was doing this, he was a member of the Bilderberg Group, a member of the Committee of 300, who was working strongly for a centralized world government who didn't care about people. You know, it was big business, and that was. And after, when he went out once during the Vietnam War, and he said some very strong words that this is another. That it was after the bombings of Hanoi that now we can add another name to the list of all of these horrible war crimes like this.
Mm-hmm.
And afterwards, he ran straight back to the power corridors and just said, "Listen, guys. Don't be afraid. No worries. I just had to do this to calm people down." This has come out in many different reports that was what he said right after doing these this speech, and I think that is what he did on a continuous basis.
Interesting.
And and then when we come up towards the assassination, about mid 1985, in the autumn of 1985, something happens. I will come into that later because I got a theory that I'm not sure very many shares with me, but I've got a theory where all of the strange, strange things that has happened in an investigation suddenly make sense, but I'll get back to that. But what happened was in late 85, 6 months before the assassination, he suddenly started to become a danger to this elite group. He started doing his own thing. He stopped arms deliveries. He stopped many different things. It was almost like he was trying to clean up the trails behind him to clean up his act. You know, that he was it was almost like he was aware of that he was coming to an end and that he wanted to clean up everything. And that made him very, very untrustworthy for the elite. And NATO and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And what we see, the months coming up to the assassination, suddenly you're starting to see a pattern of a lot of different meetings on a high level and low level as well. With NATO, people from NATO. There was one in Wiltshire where there was people from NATO. There was from the global banking system. There were politicians. There were chief of military from both Sweden, Norway, other countries like that, where they were very, very worried about how he suddenly had started to act. And it came to a point where a decision was taken to take him out.
Yeah.
At one point. And then you see also the months coming up to the assassination that there are meetings on police station with right-wing police people, very many people within the Stay Behind movement who were starting to prepare for this assassination. So it was not something that just happened. It was prepared for months and months.
And anything there is possible. He could have been basically genuine in the way he started to go rogue without, you know, the outside of their control. His, well, if you will, his programming might have failed or fallen off for some reason. Or he actually, he got in touch with some of his conscience again for some reason, and then he wanted to try to right some wrongs or whatever. In any regard, his behavior changed, and consequently he was not part of the big plan, the big game anymore. Nope. He wasn't willing to play ball, and hence he's taken out. He might even be in a position where he believed that, all right, I'm a big enough name, if you will, out there now. I can't be taken out, so now I can actually do... this is where he might have been a triple agent then in that regard. He might have wanted to be an inside of the right wing, posing as a left wing, to later actually fully bloom as another left wing, if you will. I don't know. Yeah. Anything's possible.
Like I say, I have a theory about that I strongly believe in, but let's take it further down the road because it's on a totally different level.
Okay.
But he's not the only one. Quite a few of these people who have been taken out by assassinations have been part of the elite, and then they started acting either, like you say, big-headed, like the Shah, for instance, or Margaret Thatcher, and then they were taken out, not killed, but they were taken out in other ways. And it's like when they don't have any use for you anymore, they just get rid of you.
That's right.
And if they need to, in a violent way, to show other people to back off, get back in line.
Yeah, it serves multiple purposes, obviously, to do something like this. Now, we are going to do a part two, obviously, of this and get into more details of certain things. It's such a big case. Again, the book is over 800 pages. There's just so much to talk about. But as we begin a little bit to round up for this time, for these two hours here, Ola, what should we mention next? What is some of the important things that we can talk about to kind of begin to round things up on for this time?
I don't know. There's so many. Like you say, it's such a big case. And like this book I've written, it's not because I like writing that it's 880 pages. It's just because it's so complex. So it's to be able to sort out all the strings, it's... And I can't say that I've got a complete picture either, but yeah, this is what I needed to put it all together.
Mm, yeah. Well, it's well done. And again, there's just so many things in there. How do you think, if we kind of end on a, I guess, philosophical note, how do you think Sweden would have been different today if he would have been alive? A lot of things happened consequently. Some things it was really, really bad from the point of view, if you like the welfare state, for instance. If you do want to have a country open to international trade, import, export, then it's a good thing. How do you think things would have been different today if it was able to proceed in politics and continue?
I think that the Sweden I thought that I grew up in, even though I found out later that that was an illusion as well, that there was so much going on behind the scenes, but the Sweden of the 60s, where everybody was so-called free and it was open and there was no violence, and that was beautiful, beautiful, helping people in difficult situation in other countries with asylum and all of these things, beautiful. But what happened was that after the shots were fired, just like the title of the book says, it was a coup d'etat in slow motion. Like you have a coup d'etat in a country like Chile or Argentina or something like that. It's a violent military coup that goes overnight, boom, from one leader to a militant leadership overnight. The problem that arises in a situation like that is that if you take over by force, then suddenly you have such a problem with demonstrations, guerrillas, resistant movements. So you need almost as many soldiers in the streets as the population. So you have it's really a mess to handle. So what
usually,
they did in Sweden,
sorry, Ola, but usually those that falls away too. It falls apart, rather. It actually can't sustain itself because people know that it was a violent overthrow. Yeah. They don't really deserve the power. And soon, one day, it's going to turn. And therefore, this slow motion coup d'etat that you talk about is obviously more effective. It's a long-term plan, and people are not even savvy to what actually happened. It's something that goes over a period of maybe, you know, 20 years, maybe even more in some cases, where there's fully overtaken. And this is a point I've argued for a long time, just about the Swedish system, that it is glacial when it comes to changing. It's very, very, very slow, and therefore things are does not move fast in that way. And therefore, it's also a more dangerous way of doing it, because it's something that actually is going to last and be prolonged for a very long time.
Yeah, because people don't even know what happened. They're not aware of it. I think glacial is a really good expression. I sometimes talk about stepping stones. Do you know, like, you don't take a massive step forward, but you take a little step to the left, a little to the right, a little in the middle, a little to the left, so that nobody really notices. But then all of these years later, you just look at the country and you say, oh, what happened?
Yeah.
And now Sweden is in the forefront when it comes to digital money.
Cashless society, yep.
Cashless, absolutely. Which I find as a massive, massive danger.
Yep.
There, when it comes to technical anything, surveillance, whatever it is, Sweden is just there in the forefront, showing the way for the rest of the world, which is no good at all.
I agree, and this is something that people are not smart to. The people who never visited Sweden, they might have done it once or twice. They look at it from an outside. They're fed the propaganda, which is that, you know, it's same as when Denmark and Norway. It's one of the, you know, better countries in the world, basically, and things are wonderful there economically, and things are all right and all good. And I've argued for a long time that the police state is not something that's going to arrive or come to Sweden, because it's already there. It's already firmly in place. And that's why you don't see so many police on the streets, because everything is already under control. It's
and also that people are gods themselves. You know Jantelagen,
the law that
says, do not stand out, do not do anything that no one else does, do not raise your voice, do not say anything.
That's right.
You don't need to control a country like it controls itself.
Everybody is they're the sheep and the sheepdog at the same time, you know?
I'm sorry to say that, yes, but I agree. And it's dangerous when people are not even aware of it, where everything is about the new iPhone 5 or 6 or whatever digit, blah, 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 or whatever clothes you've got, or how trendy you are, that's about it. And not noticing where we're going, where the bus is heading.
Yeah, it's true. It's become a really isolated and a cold society. I think it has been for a long time, but for different reasons and in a different way. But it's actually bloomed now, tremendously. There are interesting, ideas out there. Some that I would completely disagree with, that being proposed by some people who've actually doctored in this or studied the Swedish society and tries to argue that it's become a very individualized society. And I can't disagree more, because it's more like an ant society, and because it goes hand in hand with the Jantelag, as you mentioned before, that individually you are nobody. You're just one in the big mass, and you do not matter as an individual. And the smallest minority of all is the individual. And in society like that, it doesn't take that into account. And it's become a very, very, in the worst kind of way possible, collectivized society. And it's also consequently become very isolated. So people are not open anymore. They're very closed off. That's something I've noticed anyway.
Do you know, I heard an interview with, I think it was Ingvar Carlsson once, and somebody asked him, what is democracy? And he said, democracy is when people can say whatever they want. And I would say, sorry, Ingvar, no, it's not. Please study again. Democracy is when people make the decision and you as a politician follow that, not that people are allowed to say whatever they want. You know, because in Sweden you can say, oh, the king is blah, 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 blah. In other countries you would be shot if you said that. But in Sweden you can say that, and so you're free. apparently.
Yeah. But yeah. You're not. But that's changing too, right? With hate laws and everything. So, I mean, they're closing in on that too. You can't even express or think what you want anymore. But I guess the real issue and the real problem is so that you have to have people who are free, have a free way of thinking before you can even have people who can, you know, verbally get out what they think, because they're, you know, they have a desire to express that individuality, or that's, you know, that they are free in that sense. What's happening now is that it's becoming so homogenized and so closed off that, again, you don't need the external control, because as you said before, people are already controlling each other and policing each other. And that's the most, you know, dangerous thing that I see with that society.
Listen, Henrik, can I say another thing?
Sure, sure. Go ahead.
I would very much like to say that whoever reads this book, if they decide to do it, my intention has nothing to do with revenge or anger or getting back or anything like that. My intention is to, like with a cancer growth, to open it up, to reveal the dark inside so that the body can heal itself. The beautiful, beautiful body can get healthy again. So I'm not here to point fingers. I'm trying to show what happened historically, and so that people can wake up and make up their own mind again.
Very good. Yeah, it's called revealing the truth, no matter how much it stinks, literally. You know,
it's like with a disease. You need to open it up to a boil. You need to open it up so it can heal.
That's right. Yeah. All right. Well, why don't we wrap up things here again for this time then, Ole, with talking or giving out your website rather, and if there's anything else you want to mention that's on there, if there's any other projects you're involved in or whatnot, it's solely up to you. But again, then we want to just preface and mention the book, Coup d'etat in slow motion, and the subtitle is The Murder of Olof Palme. I urge everyone to check it out, and of course it's free for download as a PDF on the website. You can donate right there as well. Give us a URL again so we know where to go, Olof.
It's oledammegard.com. OLEDAMMEGARD.com.
All right, very good. Well, I'm looking forward to continuing and talking more about the subject, and there's many more things, of course, we're going to tie into this. But thank you for this overview, Ole. We really enjoyed it. So thank you for coming on. Thank you for sharing it with us.
Thank you so much.
Well, that's our program for today. Thank you for listening and for entertaining the ideas and the research that we present. We ask no one to believe anything, but that you take the ideas to heart and think about it. See how it fits into your picture that you're trying to formulate. Do your own research and continue to listen to Red Ice Radio as we highlight new areas and material that we think all fits into a larger picture. Our attempt to help understand the world and history from a truthful and honest perspective. Certainly by no means have we covered it all. There is more to come, and we do our best to keep looking into new areas and re-evaluate what we think we know. Thanks to everyone making Red Ice possible, and that includes you. Take good care. We will talk to you soon.